Today's Taisho will be on case 40 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 40 is entitled Tipping Over a Water Bottle. When Isan Osho was with Hyakujo, he was Tenzo, or head cook, of the monastery. Hyakujo wanted to choose a master for Mount Tai-i, so he called together all the monks and told them that anyone who could answer his question in an outstanding manner would be chosen. Then he took a water bottle and stood it on the floor and said, "You may not call this a water bottle. What do you call it?" The head monk said, "It cannot be called a stump." Hyakujo asked Isan his opinion. Isan tipped over the water bottle with his feet and went out. Hyakujo laughed and said, "The head monk loses." And Isan was named as the founder of the new monastery. Mumon's comment, Isan displayed great spirit in his actions, but he could not cut himself free from Hyakujo's apron strings. He preferred the heavier task to the lighter one. Why was he like that, eh? He took off his headband in order to bear the iron yoke. Mumon's verse, "Tossing bamboo baskets and ladles away, he made a glorious dash and swept all before him. Hyakujo's barrier cannot stop his advance. Thousands of Buddhas come forth from the tips of his feet." Thank you for coming here to practice Zen this morning on this beautiful winter day. Earlier this last week, it was almost 60 degrees. Actually, it was slightly more than 60 degrees on Wednesday. And last night, it was something like 15 degrees. And this morning, the sky is very clear. It's cold, but it's very clear. And that blue sky is really just quite wonderful, quite inspiring. In Zen, the state of awareness that's associated with awakening is often represented by the image of the blue sky. So sometimes enlightened mind is referred to as lan tien, blue sky. In Japanese, this is aozo, blue sky. Blue sky mind is quite highly valued. Earlier this week, the sky wasn't blue at all. One morning, I think it might have been Wednesday, when it was so warm, I got up and everything was shrouded in a dense fog, and it was difficult to see. Even 20 feet ahead of me was difficult where I live. People would drive up with their headlamps on, and the headlamps in the fog would actually make their cars more difficult to see. That is a very dangerous situation. And indeed, last week I actually myself had an accident, had an auto accident. I was on my own street, and I was pulling out onto Woodland, and because of these conditions, atmospheric conditions, somebody hit me on the side of my car. Fortunately, I was fine, but it could have been a bad accident. The person who hit me was coming around a corner. It was dark and foggy, and he was probably going a little too fast. I stopped at a stop sign, and I was pulling out into the road. And I looked to my left, and I looked to my right, and when I looked to my right, I started to pull out, and then this guy came around the corner and hit me. So technically, I actually think it was my fault. I was pulling into traffic, and I didn't see him coming. But nobody was hurt. It was fortunate. My car is in the shop, and hopefully I'll get it out on Friday. These things happen. You know, the atmospheric conditions weren't right, and when the guy hit me, he was hopping mad. He just was absolutely hopping, jumping up and down. He was so mad. And he hit me with quite a big car. He had a 1998 Lincoln Continental. If you know anything about American cars, this is a gigantic car. And it must weigh tons. Fortunately, it didn't really totally wreck my car. It just crushed the driver's door. My door. But everything was okay. You know, he came around the corner so fast, and I realized I didn't have time to back up. So I just closed my eyes, you know. And I thought, oh no, you know, and then wham. And then it was okay. I thought, my God, I'm okay, and nothing hurts, you know. So, you know, I pulled the car off the road, and he pulled his car off the road, and then he was very, very mad for a long time. And I said, listen, I'm sorry, you know, accidents happen. I didn't mean to cause you an accident. And we talked for a while, and he began to calm down, and, you know, we called the police, and he said, oh, my boss is going to, you know, be mad at me. I've been late before. I was trying to get to work early. And I said, yeah, but, you know, you can show him the accident report. You can, you know, you have proof that this happened. And so by the end, we were talking very cordially with one another. We began to get calmer and more composed. The shock of that moment really threw everything into disarray. And, you know, sometimes when people are in disarray, you can see, you can see sort of where they are. You know, where they are in their lives. It's easy to be calm, collected, and compassionate when everything's going well. Not everybody manages to do that, but nevertheless, you know, on a nice day, there are no challenges. You know, you might feel generous when somebody comes to the door and asks you to contribute to something. You might help somebody who's struggling with a flat tire if you're not in a hurry, you know. But when people are in a kind of crisis situation or when they're off balance, you can often see, you know, where they are, you know, what their state of mind it often is under the surface, you know. And this guy, you know, once the accident happened, you know, he was like really mad. He was jumping up and down, and he was, what were you thinking? You know, what were you thinking? Well, I mean, I was thinking I would pull out in front of your car and you would hit me. Of course, what else? Naturally, I didn't say that. I just said, well, listen, I'm sorry. You know, I didn't see you coming. You know, there's a bit of a curve there, you know. But you know, he was already tense, right? I mean, an accident makes you tense, but he was already tense, right? I mean, he even said, you know, my boss is going to skin me alive or something. He was very worried about being late, and he was probably speeding, you know. So, you know, his anxiety was right under the surface, and when this happened, it exploded all over the street, you know. And then, you know, but he you know, he began to get calmer. And actually, at the end, he did a very generous thing, you know. My hat had fallen onto the ground. I had, like, this wool cap. And I didn't know it was on the ground. And then I turned around and saw it on the ground. And I said, is that your hat? And he said, no, it's yours. And he leaned down, and he picked it up, and he handed it to me. Which is a way of saying, you know, I understand, you know, accidents happen, you're okay, you know, So we shook hands after the policeman didn't write up a ticket for me because he said, you know, it was foggy, you know. He said, I'm supposed to write you a ticket because there's a stop sign. And I said, but I stopped. And he said, yes, but you're supposed to stop and yield, not stop and drive into traffic. So I said, now I understand. No, No, I didn't say that. I just said, I didn't say anything. I looked very sad and contrite. So he didn't write me a ticket, which was a good thing. And that was over with, you know. But that, though, that's, you know, that those things happen, right? And when they happen, we can sometimes see, when things don't go our way, we can sometimes see what our state of mind is under the surface, you know. Little later in the week, you know, I was driving my wife's car and went out to lunch with a friend of mine and had a wonderful afternoon, and I just, you know, felt everything was wonderful. And, today I got up and drove here, and I don't know if you noticed, but early in the morning as the sun was coming up, the sky was absolutely beautiful, you know. And around the horizon it was pink, and the sky is this very, very blue, and it shades down into this rose color above the horizon. Just a beautiful day. And that that sky, that beautiful sky, is sort of representative or symbol of what in Zen we think of as a very highly desirable state of mind. You know, sometimes the sky is blue and clear, but and sometimes it's foggy and you can't see, and sometimes it's covered with clouds. Yesterday, it actually snowed in the middle of the day. I don't know if you noticed that, but the sky became very dark, and snow came down in real profusion. It was like this very small flakes just coming down profusely for a little while, and then it all went away. You know, this is like the mind, right? You know, sometimes the mind is clear and unobstructed. Sometimes it's foggy. Sometimes it's storm-tossed, you know. The basic idea is that the mind is fundamentally always like the blue sky. You know, actually, you can have clouds, you can have snow, but above the snow and the clouds, there's the blue sky. So the clouds are sort of like an intermediate condition between heaven and earth. And basically, on earth that you look up and it's dark, stormy. We had these intense winds, as you know. Snow is coming down, and snow is quite beautiful, you know. And then there's the dark clouds, and above the dark clouds there's this blue sky. Well, this is very much the way Zen believes the mind is, you know, that actually, you know, there's different layers to the mind, and we can be caught up in details of the moment in a way that triggers all of our anxieties and all of our fears. And we can be very storm-tossed and like blown about by these powerful winds, you know. But there's a layer of the mind, there's a level of the mind which is absolutely imperturbable. And it's clear and unobstructed all the time. We don't always manage to get to that layer of the mind, but when we do, you know, it's quite wonderful, and it's especially wonderful if we can get there when things are not going well. You know, one of the reasons we do Zen training, actually, is to be able to get to that place even in times of trouble. So, you know, as I said, it's easy to be in that state when it's a nice day and everything is going well. I went out for lunch with my friend, and I came out of the restaurant and I looked up and I thought, oh, it's so, you know, life is so beautiful. I'm glad I wasn't hurt in the accident. You know, I just had a very nice lunch, Thai food. You know, I had an open afternoon where I could just putter around and do my work. There were no pressures. You know, so in that state, it's easy to believe, you know, that on some level the mind is open and unobstructed. But you know, we all get into these places where we feel very claustrophobic, very boxed in. You know, where there seems to be no exit in any direction. And when that happens, when we get into that state, you know, we can have these explosive emotions. You know, fear, you know, or anger. You know, that state of feeling obstructed or blocked or boxed in is very revealing. You know, we see a lot about ourselves when we're in that state. The ideal condition would be to be in that blue sky mind even when things are not going well. But that takes a lot of training. That takes a lot of training. You really have to have done a lot of sitting, and you really have to have, you have to sort of know yourself very well. By know yourself, I mean you have to know your own fears, your own anxieties, your own mental games very well. Because when we're in distress, we often go back to those games we play so often with ourselves. And if we can recognize them as our familiar games, then they're not so persuasive, you know. When people do zazen, you know, we sit down on the cushion, and at first, our minds are like exploding with thoughts. Last night, we had three new people. I was so happy to see three new people last night. And, you know, for them, Zen was a challenge. Sitting for 2 half-hour periods was quite challenging. And at the end of the evening, I asked everybody who was new to stick around, and I invited them to come up to speak with me, and one of them, I said, "How was it?" And she said, "Oh, that was really hard. You know, my mind was just all over the place." And her companion, her friend, said the same thing. She said, "Oh, you know, it's like a madhouse in there." This is actually true. You know, the mind is at first like a monkey. You know, it's often compared to a monkey in the sutras. It's easily distracted. It flits from thing to thing. Another way to think of it, it's like a rushing stream, right? It's just this torrent of thoughts and emotions just pouring by. And you know, normally we're caught up in that flow, right? I mean, normally. We identify with our thoughts, and our thoughts produce emotions involuntarily. So, you know, if you have an unpleasant experience, say you have to meet somebody at work, and you're supposed to make them feel at ease, maybe they're a guest from another company, and your job is to make them feel at ease, but something goes terribly wrong, and they're not happy, and they leave, and your boss is going to hear about it. This is like a classic situation. So your job was to make sure that they had a good time, or that they were comfortable, and their needs were taken care of, but somehow it backfires, you know. As you're driving home, you probably think about this, you know. You think about this person's being disappointed. You might be angry at some of your coworkers for not for letting the ball drop. You might be angry at yourself for not paying enough attention to the situation, and you might be fearful about what your boss is going to say. And all of this is going around and around in your head the whole time you're driving home. You know, when you get home, you might not realize it, but you're probably anxious, a little sad. There might be some, anxiety, also some anger, you know. And these things are normally below the level of attention. So, you know, maybe you turn on the TV and you have a glass of wine while you're waiting for dinner. And then, you know, you have dinner and you go to sleep. But all the time this is under the surface, you know. And there's a kind of turbulence which is hard to escape from, you know. So, you know, in Zen, you know, when we sit down on the cushion, sometimes you encounter whatever is in there, you know. So you sit down, you watch your breath, and then you might replay the events of the last day that have caused you so much distress. And what normally happens is we replay these and replay them and replay them. But sometimes if we meditate a lot and we practice, you know, you will get into this wonderful state, which we call samadhi. And normally, you know, your awareness is carried forward by this torrent of thoughts. It's really like associations. So, you know, you think of your boss, you think of the guest coming, you think of what happened next, you think of your boss's anger, you maybe remember your dad being mad at you or something like that, and you find your anxiety level rising and rising, you know. So this is typical, you know, there's under the surface there's this torrent of thoughts or associations, and these are triggering very rapidly all of these emotional responses. You know, normally we identify with our thoughts. This is almost, most people don't realize there's an alternative to this. You know, mostly we identify so thoroughly with our own thinking that we don't have any space between our thoughts and ourselves. You know. Early meditation early on is a struggle with this situation, you know, where you're trying to focus on the breath, but you're absorbed by your thoughts and they're carrying you forward relentlessly and automatically. You know, the big challenge of starting to do meditation is to fix the mind on the breath, as opposed to traveling forward with your thoughts. And when you hold on to the breath, it's like being in a torrent and finding a rock you can hold on to as everything is roaring by you. You know, so the breath is like your rock, and you hang on. And the water of thoughts, the river of thoughts or the stream of thoughts is rushing by you, you know. But the breath gives you like a stability or a fixity. And sometimes you let go and you go down the stream, but if you can just hang on to your breath, you'll begin to feel a kind of stability or a kind of immobility. The breath will anchor you in the moment, you know. And, you know, you're like somebody hanging on to a rock in a stream. Eventually, you know, eventually you might calm down and realize, wait, I'm safe. You know, I'm not going to go down the stream. And you might begin to look around and notice, you know, the leaves on the trees or hear the birds, you know. You know, ordinarily we're so intensely distracted. But every once in a while, especially if you do meditation, you know, you watch the breath, but there might be a moment suddenly where you begin to grow still. Your mind begins to grow still, and instead of this racing torrent of thoughts being right at the center of your attention, it shifts away. So you're like that person holding on to a rock in a stream. You suddenly realize, I'm not going to be swept down. And you begin to look around and notice what's happening. Now, this is a real breakthrough. This state of, you know, the ability to hold on to the breath in the sutras is called one-pointed mind. This goes back to ancient Buddhism, this phrase. You have to develop a one-pointed mind. You have to be able to bring the mind back to the breath repetitively. And if you can do that for a while, you will begin to have this stability and focus, like the man on the rock or the woman hanging onto the rock. You know, you suddenly, in the midst of all this torrent, there's this stability. And this is really the first experience of samadhi. And this state of stabilization, mental stabilization, can sometimes be accompanied by a kind of elation or bliss. You know, sometimes in our sitting we really feel wonderful. When you can get the mind to that place, it's still and almost imperturbable. It's incredibly liberating, you know, as I'm sure you know. Instead of being sort of like a prisoner of our mental processing, we finally are able to break free from it, you know, and just not have these being swept forward by the chain of thinking and not having these automatic emotional responses. Getting to this kind of mental stability is hard work. You know, it takes many, many, many sits. But I can't praise it highly enough. This is so liberating. You know, I myself am not always in the blue sky, you know. So, you know, sometimes I find myself, especially in an event like the accident I had, you know, I lose my mental equilibrium. You know, I would like to say that I had the accident, I walked out of the car and I thought, ah, everything's okay, what a lovely day, you know. But it really wasn't like that. I was in some distress too. You know, I thought to myself, oh my gosh, you know, is he hurt? You know, what have I done? Well, how could I be so stupid? And I have my own illusions that are my, you know, I said you have to know yourself. You know, I know myself pretty well. I know that in a situation like this, I'm likely to be very self-critical. You know, I mean, I always am in these kinds of situations. So there was a sense of, you know, oh my gosh, you know, what a jerk I am, or what a dope I am, and so on and so on. And then, you know, because I recognize these familiar, this is the familiar furniture of my small mind, you could say. It's like going into a room you know very well. You know, over here is the chair of self-contempt, right? You know, and here is the chair, you know, and here's the table where I do this, you know. And so I went through my familiar emotions, and my many years of Zen practice have made this all quite plain to me, you know. So, you know, when I would do koan practice sometimes and I wouldn't answer my koan, I would think, you know, what an idiot! How can you be so stupid? You know, is that... Now, when I do that, I recognize that. You know, I realize this is something I tend to do when I confront an obstacle or I'm off balance, you know. And on this occasion, too, you know, I went through some of this routine and then I realized this is my familiar routine. You know, and I did what I do on a cushion. You know, I just, while I was waiting for the police and this guy was jumping up and down, I started watching my breath. And I started, you know, paying attention to my dantian, my hara. And, of course, I became calm right away. You know, it was just like magic. I mean, 35 years of training really pay off, you know. And I felt suddenly very serene, very much in control of the situation. And I could be helpful to somebody else who wasn't in that state, you know. And, you know, when I went over and talked with him, I was able to sort of like talk him down, right? And as I say, at the end, we were sort of, you know, laughing. And, you know, he shook my hand. It was very warm and genuine and, you know, so on. So, you know, having that ability not to be swept forward is tremendously important. And it takes a long time, but it's quite, quite liberating, you know, not to be trapped in our mental, our habitual mental patterns. This is especially important in another way too. You know, when we're normally going through a series of events, we are also having these conditioned responses to new events as they arise. You know. So, you know, one event will happen, and then another event will happen, and maybe. We're getting anxious, you know, and as our anxiety builds, we are less able to deal with what's happening next, right? So, you know, if your guest is coming to the company and your job is supposed to be to make sure everything is good, maybe he's supposed to have lunch and the lunch doesn't show up in time and he gets impatient. You know, as he's waiting for his lunch, you're thinking, oh my God, I've screwed this up. My boss is going to be furious, right? And we'll lose the account, something like that. You know, and so as now, things are even worse, right? When he arrived, you were a little bit worried. Now the lunch hasn't come, and you're imagining you're going to lose the account. So now your anxiety level is twice what it was initially, right? And so in that state of anticipating something bad or anticipating something that is... going to be uncontrollably difficult to deal with. You know, you're really, people are often very much paralyzed. You know, our anxiety, our fear can cause us to become very passive, very immobile. And we allow events to come one after another, and we're sort of like just being battered by them. This is probably familiar to you. So, you know, this state is especially, people can get into this state especially if they've had similar experiences before that have been painful or difficult. So, you know, if you had a guest come to the company and it didn't work out, the next time a guest comes, you know, it might even be more difficult to deal with. And even smaller things might cause you great distress. You know, so being able to cultivate this state, this blue sky mind, this mind that's stable and serene, is or get to that place where you're holding on to the rock of your breath and you're stabilizing yourself, is really crucial, really important. Because, you know, we can't really respond to challenges if we're paralyzed by anxiety. We can't really be creative if we're motivated primarily by fear. Fear is like the worst possible motivator. When we make, you know, just generally speaking, in my life, I would say the worst decisions I have ever made have been decisions that are based on fear and my desire to get away from fear and be safe. Usually those are bad decisions. You know, please hear me, I'm speaking from experience. When you make a decision out of fear and your goal is just to be safe, usually that's a bad decision. Better decisions come from a different place. You know, when you're not motivated by fear, when you're in that kind of blue sky mind, you can be responsive and creative. So the goal is not just to get out of trouble, out of the way of trouble. It's to be creative, to be responsive and active. See, people often think of Zen as being about passivity or withdrawal. There's a Zen teacher who's quite well known, and I respect him a lot. And he was interviewed in Tricycle magazine, and they said, "What is your Zen teaching?" And he said, "Don't just do something, sit there." See, and I thought that's very clever, but I don't agree. You know, "Don't just do something, sit there" is an intermediate step. You know, at first we want to do something, anything to get out of the firing line, right? People are often frenetically active because they're anxious. You know, so if things didn't go well at work, you might come home and you vacuum the floor, or you make an extra, you know, special dinner, or you do something, you're busy in order not to deal with your anxiety. You know, so having to sit down on a cushion and confront your anxiety is difficult but really good for you. And eventually, you know, you might get to a place where your mind really is stable and calm, and you're like that person holding on to a rock. So at that level, to say don't just do something, sit there, is actually good advice. But it's not the optimum condition. You know, beware of clinging to that state of immobility. It's very tempting, but it's not Zen. You know, in this koan, there's a teacher, Isan Osho. Osho means priest. When Isan Osho was with Hyakujo, he was the tenzo, or cook, the tienzo. Of the monastery, Hyakujo wanted to choose. They were opening up a branch temple on Mount Tai'i, and Hyakujo wanted to find out which of his students was the most advanced student at the time, so he could send the most advanced student to run the new temple. And he created a little contest. He put a bottle on the floor, right? In the Zendo, and he said, "You may not call this a water bottle. What would you call it?" See, so he's challenging his students to respond actively, not passively. See, to the situation. We see this in other Zen stories too. In the famous story, Nansen kills a cat. Nansen says, "If you can tell me one word of Zen, I will not cut this cat in two. But if you can't say something, I will cut it in two, and nobody can speak. And he cuts the cat in two. In this case, the teacher puts a bottle on the floor and he says, you can't call it a bottle. What are you going to do? In other words, you know, you can't just sit passively by and stay out of trouble. You've got to be active. You have to act. As events are unfolding, we need to withdraw. It's true, we need to cling to the rock. We need to sit down on the cushion and watch the breath until we can stabilize the mind. But on the other hand, once the mind is stable and grounded, we have to act creatively and spontaneously in the world. We can't cling to that that passivity. That's not Zen. So a person who is in great distress needs to learn how to calm the mind. That's step one. Step two is being able to be in that motionless, imperturbable state. But step three is being able to stay in that blue sky mind while you're acting in the world. See, that's the highest state. Very difficult. When Hyakujo throws down a challenge, basically, the head monk looks at the bottle and says, okay, if I can't call it a bottle, I'll say it isn't a stump. Now, this is a terrible answer. Really terrible. I've given many answers like this, but it's an intellectual answer, for one thing, which makes it terrible in a Zen sense, but also it's trying to avoid making a mistake. See, the head monk is trying to avoid making a mistake. It's still coming from a place that is, the head monk is still holding back. He's still acting from a place, maybe a little bit of fear. So, okay, it's not a bottle. I wouldn't call it a stump. I'm safe. It's a safe answer, right? It's a bit of a decision made in fear. Maybe the head monk is anxious because he's afraid he will not give a good answer and then he will be shown to be not the great Zen student he wanted to be. See, so he's playing it safe. His answer is coming out a little bit of a kind of dread of the next moment, which might unfold uncontrollably in ways that don't work to his advantage. So he says, I wouldn't call it a stump. Now, the Isan, who is the cook, the cook in a temple is often, very often, the cook is the most advanced student. Did you know that? You might think, what a waste, you know, shouldn't the most advanced student be, in the Zendo? But no, that's not the Zen view. The most advanced student is in the kitchen. See, I mean, if you say, what is the most important job in the temple? You know, what's the most important job? You could say, oh, the Roshi. It's wrong. The Roshis come and go. You know, they're a dime a dozen. That's the truth. But you've got to have a good tenzo, or the place falls apart. You know, everybody is going to be hungry. You know, when I at Sashin, I'm starved all the time. You know, and if food is not good, you know, that's a real problem. It's disheartening, right? You know, you're sitting 9 hours a day, your legs hurt. You come in and you have something good to eat. It's like, oh. You know, I can do it. You know, let me back at that cushion, you know. If the food is terrible, it's the challenge. You know, the tenzo is taking care of everybody in the most foundational way. You know, Imtiaz, as you all know, is an incredibly good cook. You know, and it's not just that he's a good cook. You know, there's so much love in all that food he prepares. Every time I eat it, I realize this is a labor of love. Somebody has made this food in order to help other people, as an expression of love. And you know, this is actually a very wonderful teaching of Zen. You know that you make food that's good and it sustains people and lifts their spirits. And the whole Sangha benefits from this, you know. In the Zen tradition, a most advanced student is often in the kitchen. And of course, if you run a kitchen, you can't fool around, right? You have to get the meals ready. You have to chop, we all get together and we chop the vegetables. We have to, we have to be focused. You have to cut the vegetables. If you have a sharp knife in your hand, you can cut your finger off, so you have to pay attention. And you have to move quickly, and everything has to be done right, right? So this is a dynamic Zen, right? This is Zen in action, and you have to be open, you can have your recipe book and you can put the ingredients in and it just doesn't come together. This happens again and again. Cooking is such a good Zen training because, you can follow the recipe and it just doesn't, it's not alive, Sometimes you just experiment and it comes out, it's wonderful, and you think, how did I do this, And you try it again, it doesn't quite work. But, sometimes you just stumble into like a wonderful meal. And when you try to duplicate it 2 days later, it's not the same, This is like life, right? It's the Tao of cooking. The Tao of cooking, you're trying to do this. You have to be precise, but you also have to be open to possibilities, And if you're too fearful or neurotic, you can't really be a good cook, So Isan is working in the kitchen, and he's doing all this important work of keeping the Sangha going. And probably Hyakujo already knows Isan is a more advanced than the head monk. So he puts the bottle on the floor and he says, okay, head monk, do your stuff. And the head monk is afraid. And he says, oh, well, okay, not a water bottle. Let's say it's not a stump. Okay. Then Isan, get Isan out of the kitchen. And Isan's in the kitchen. He's got on his apron. There's stuff's all, food on the apron. He says, okay, Isan, you can't call it a water bottle. How are you going to respond? And Isan jumps up and kicks it over. See? Now that's Zen spontaneity. That's coming from that blank mind, that blue sky mind, right? It's coming from that. The ideal state in Zen is to be able to be in that motionless samadhi and acting in the world. So that moment by moment, you're not responding in a conditioned way, in a way that's conditioned by your previous fears, anxieties, and memories. It's like open, you're 100% present every time, every moment, and you're not allowing your mind to be arrested or stopped. See? You're not allowing. Sometimes, you're just flowing. It's a cliche, going with the flow. But going with the flow is a very good state. There's a man named Chick Mahalia. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, but Chick Mahalia. I'm probably not pronouncing it right now. But he wrote a book called Flow, and he said there's a flow state. Where people are just present in they're mindfully present in the moment as events unfold, and they're going with the flow. And he said this is actually a very, very important human state. And Zen would say absolutely, this is one of the things we strive for. So sometimes we're going with the flow. You're doing something and it's all working out, and then all of a sudden something will happen. You get an email and it just stops the flow. It's like, now your fears kick in, or now your anxiety kicks in, and it's like everything is now frozen, right? So this could have happened to Isan, but it didn't. Isan is used to being in the flow. He's able to cultivate this samadhi mind on the cushion. And now off the cushion, he's in that samadhi mind when he's chopping vegetables and so on and so on. And when he's called into a new situation, he doesn't hang back with a little bit of dread or fear. He just acts. And he doesn't worry about being right or wrong. He's just acting from that empty place with a kind of trust in himself or trust in the world. In Zen, this is called the trusting mind. The great way is one with the trusting mind. See, that's a Sengsan's great teaching. So this is like a little story that illustrates the Xinxin Ming is all about. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. You have to be one with the trusting mind. And so he just acts. And of course, anything he did with the water bottle would be okay. You know, he could have spun it on his nose. He could have, you know, whatever. Anything would have been okay. The important thing is that he wasn't arrested by the event. He was able to act spontaneously. See, he wasn't frozen. Any answer he gave would have been an appropriate one. And this is so often the case in life, right? Just responding is often good enough, you know. Of course, you know, this state is difficult. You know, it's not always possible to be in this state. And if you're not in this state, you shouldn't blame yourself. That just makes things worse. You know, it's very important to make time for zazen. If you want to be spontaneous, you can't just order yourself to be spontaneous, right? If it were only that easy. Americans sometimes underestimate the importance of training in every area. I was reading this article that said, actually Asian people do much better in math and other scientific subjects than Western people in these tests of high school students. And, you know, actually, Americans don't do well at all. We get smeared. And some psychologists said, you know, okay, when you give these people, tests of mental ability, they're at pretty much the same level. So how come these Asians smear us, you know? And it turns out that it has to do with their attitude, not surprisingly. You know, when they interview, native-born Americans, they find that Americans explain their successes and their failures in terms of talent. So when an American kid tries to do math and doesn't succeed, both he and his parents will say, "Well, you just don't have a talent in that area." See, Asian parents don't apparently, according to these psychologists, say, "Well, they don't even they don't believe in talent. It's like you have to learn this, right?" And it's all assumed to be a matter of hard work. It's all assumed to be a matter of hard work. They don't have a culture where this idea of talent particularly exists. So if you're not doing a good job, it's because you're not applying yourself, right? Now this is the very opposite of the American view. So the American view is if you're not talented in math, go find something you are talented in. You know, and this could lead to a lifetime of searching and never finding anything. And the Asian view is, what do you mean you're not going to do your algebra? Get in there and do your algebra, you know. And so actually, it pays off, right? The diligence pays off. And even in Zen, this is the case, you know. I mean, when I first started doing Zen and I wasn't answering my koans, I actually did think, maybe I just don't have a talent for this, you know. A typical American response. And my Zen training was really crushing in a way, because I kept failing. And I realized now it was such good training, you know, because it made me realize, you know, you just have to apply yourself more. You know, it's important not to just spend every waking minute sitting on your cushion. It's good to go out and have friends. It's good to go to the movies. But on the other hand, waking up, enlightenment is not a matter of talent. You know, nobody has a talent for enlightenment. It's like everything else, it requires hard work. So if you want to have an imperturbable mind, you have to spend some time on the cushion. And you have to work through your obstacles and get to that serene place. And little by little, you'll notice that when you're off the cushion, you know, you're also very serene and less hysterical, you know. When I started doing Zen training, I was like, I think I was like hysterical all the time, you know. And years later, when I came to New Jersey and was running the writing program, the person who had been the director of the program came in one day and he said, "I don't recognize this place." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "It's so calm." And I thought, huh, that's interesting. You know. And then a little later, we were having a crisis, and my secretary came in and she said, "You know, you seem so calm about all of this." And I was, and I hadn't really thought about it, but I just realized, you know, I am calm, you know. Now, I have to tell you the truth, I'm not always calm, you know. Sometimes I can be quite neurotic. But there are moments where I really am grateful for my Zen training, you know, because I realize, gee, I can deal with this. You know, it's not the end of the world. You know, and in that state, you can be creative. You can help others. You can make life better for lots of people. When Isan Osho was with Hyakujo, he was Tenzo, or head cook, of the monastery. Hyakujo wanted to choose a master for Mount Tai'i, so he called together all the monks and told them that anyone who could answer his question in an outstanding manner would be chosen. Then he took a water bottle and stood it on the floor and said, "You may not call this a water bottle. What do you call it?" The head monk said, "It cannot be called a stump." Hyakujo asked Isan his opinion. Isan tipped over the water bottle with his feet and went out. Hyakujo laughed and said, "The head monk loses." And Isan was named the founder of the new monastery. Mumon's comment: Isan displayed great spirit in his actions, but he could not cut himself free from Hyakujo's apron strings. Remember that in Zen, that kind of an insult is a compliment. So what he's really saying is that Isan and Hyakujo had a loving student-teacher relationship. He preferred the heavier task to the lighter one. In other words, he rose to the challenge. Why was he like that, eh? Because he wasn't afraid. He took off his headband to bear the iron yoke of service to others. Mumon's verse: tossing bamboo baskets and ladles away, he made a glorious dash and swept all before him. Hyakujo's barrier cannot stop his advance. Thousands of Buddhas come forth from the tips of his feet.